This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran says guarantees on the removal of sanctions are necessary for any agreement to revive the JCPOA. It calls on the U.S. to show political will for a deal. A bomb attack near the entrance to the Russian embassy in the African capital leaves two people dead and several more injured. Canadian police launch a manhunt for two suspected of killing 10 people in a stabbing spree in a remote indigenous community. This is World News from Tehran. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Iran says the negotiations to revive the 2015 nuclear deal could come to a conclusion if the United States shows political will.
If there is a political will and if the United States follows suit on Iran and acts constructively, if they seek to move forward, the negotiations could come to a conclusion in a short time and we can hopefully reach an agreement.
The official says that Iran has conveyed to the EU its viewpoints on the latest U.S. response on how to conclude the talks. Kanani says this is a show of Tehran's determination to resolve differences. The spokesman also said that guarantees on the removal of sanctions are necessary for any agreement. He said that the same goes for an end to the persistent anti-Iran allegations by the IAEA. Kanani stressed that Iran expects the agency to act within its own professional obligations. Iran is warning that it will not tolerate new threats by the United States to maritime security in the region. The chief of staff of Iran's armed forces says that there are reports that unmanned spying units are being deployed to regional waters. Major General Mohammad Daghari says Iranian vessels will not tolerate the presence of such equipment in their route and will make sure to counter them. He says Iran will protect its right to freedom and security navigation in international waters. Now, those comments came days after Iran seized two U.S. surface drones in the Red Sea for endangering maritime traffic. A bombing attack has taken place outside the Russian embassy in the Afghan capital. Police says a suicide bomber detonated explosives near the entrance to the mission. Moscow says that two embassy staff have been killed in that explosion. A correspondent Abdullah Amirzadeh has the details.
We do not yet know, no one has claimed the explosion, but it is said as people were gathered near the embassy and it was very crowded, they were applying for visas either, or they were processing the visas they had applied before. It was crowded and it is said that a suicide attacker got close, somehow managed to get close to the crowd, and before getting so close to the main gate, he was shot with the Taliban forces. It is said that the bullets went off the suicide vest and the explosion occurred after the shooting. Sources have different number of casualties and dead. What we know, what is official up to now by Afghan sources, is that one person is dead and 15 are wounded. But the Russian credible sources say at least two Russian staffers were also among the dead. So we do not know exactly how many people have died or how many people are wounded. We must wait on that matter.
Now, same with Afghanistan, at least eight people have been confirmed dead in a quake that rocked the country's northeast in the early hours of Monday. But that's reported in the province of Kunar along the eastern border with Pakistan. Authorities expect a toll to rise. They're also reporting financial damage. The epicenter of the 5.3 magnitude tremor was near the city of Jalalabad. The earthquake was also felt in capital Kabul. Afghanistan is still reeling from a strong quake that killed more than 1,000 people and injured over 1,500 others in June. Now moving to Afghanistan's neighbor China, where a 6.6 magnitude earthquake has left at least seven people dead. It hit the Sichuan province in the southwest. Initial reports show houses in a number of towns have sustained serious damage. Telecommunication lines have been cut off in some areas. Chinese media says over 500 rescue workers have been sent to the epicenter. Several aftershocks in nearby areas have also been reported. Palestinians have held a funeral for a young man who was shot dead by Israeli forces in the northern occupied West Bank. According to the Palestinian Health Ministry, Tahar Mohammed Zakarna was shot in the head and the legs in a town south of Jenin. He was targeted during an Israeli raid on the town this morning. Arrests were also made. Tensions are mounting across the occupied territories amid Israel's escalating raids and crackdown. Palestinians conduct retaliatory operations to avenge the regime's atrocities. On Sunday, gunmen wounded 11 Israeli troopers in an attack on a bus near the city of Tubas in the occupied West Bank.
Well, the operation time was to Abati, a town south of Jenin, northern the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces raided Qabati town, and Israeli troops surrounded a house. They were demanding a Palestinian. They claimed that he was wanted for security reasons to surrender. Clashes, of course, took place between the Israeli soldiers and Palestinians who threw stones and rocks at the fully armed Israeli forces to prevent them from arresting Palestinians. The Israeli troops used live bullets. As you have mentioned, 19-year-old Tahar Zakarni was seriously wounded and transferred to hospital. There's another Palestinian who was wounded during this operation to Qabati. The Israeli troops arrested at least four Palestinians before they pulled out from the Qabati area. Elsewhere in the occupied West Bank, Palestinian Commission of Prisoners Affairs declared that at least 19 Palestinians were wounded this morning, were arrested during Israeli military raids to several areas in Jenin and Beit Lahem, Nablus, and Ramallah. All those, the Israelis claim that they are wanted for security reasons.
In Yemen, the oil ministry has held a press conference in capital Sana'a to shed light on the looting of the country's crude oil by Saudi Arabia and the UAE. It says that Riyadh and its allies continue to block Yemeni fuel ships and steal the country's oil, and that's despite a UN-brokered truce. More in the next report by Abdulatif Al-Washali.
Yemen is facing a fuel crisis as Saudi Arabia and its allies continue to block fuel ships in violation of a UN brokered truce and steal the country's crude oil. Yemen's Ministry of Oil has held a press conference in Sana'a to discuss the issue.
There are 13 oil basins in Yemen, of which only two are invested, namely Safar and Al-Masila, at a rate of only 18%. These basins are located in Marib and Shabwa, and they are controlled by the Saudi-backed forces. They are continuously being looted, and this reflects negatively on the Yemeni economy. The systematic looting is one of the reasons for the years-long war against us by Saudi Arabia and its allies.
The ministry says the plundered oil is worth billions of dollars, which is enough to pay the suspended salaries of Yemeni employees. It held the Saudi-led coalition responsible for cutting off the salaries as the oil sales are being supplied to Saudi banks.
What the Saudi-led coalition is doing is the systematic looting of Yemeni oil and gas. The total amount that was looted from 2018 until July 2022 is about 130 million barrels, with a total value of about $9.5 billion. This money is enough to pay the Yemenis suspended salaries for 5 years. Unfortunately, they give the money from the plundered oil to the National Bank of Saudi Arabia and not the Central Bank of Yemen.
Yemen's petroleum company warned of an imminent fuel crisis as Riyadh is still preventing 9 fuel ships from entering the country, which is a clear violation of the UN brokered truce. However, the world body remains silent toward the Saudi violations. As Yemenis face a fuel crash due to the Saudi blockade, they are urging the United Nations to force Riyadh to fulfill its commitments under the ceasefire agreement and to stop detaining fuel ships headed to the country. They say pillaging Yemeni oil also reveals why the Saudi-led coalition launched a war on their country. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Remote Canadian communities are shaken by a stabbing rampage. At least 10 people have been killed and many more injured in multiple attacks in Saskatchewan province near the border with the U.S.
At this point in our investigation, we have located 10 deceased individuals in 13 locations in the community of James Smith Cree Nation and Weldon, Saskatchewan.
Police have located the deceased individuals in 13 locations in the remote Indigenous community. 15 of those injured have been transferred to hospitals. Some of the victims are said to have been targeted, while others were randomly attacked. The suspects are still at large. The intention behind the stabbing attacks is not known yet. Police have issued emergency alert all across Saskatchewan and adjoining Alberta and Manitoba provinces. A manhunt has been launched for two suspects. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has described the mass stabbing as horrific and heartbreaking. The UK's Conservative Party is set to announce the successor to Prime Minister Boris Johnson in the coming hours. Foreign Secretary Liz Truss and former Finance Secretary Rishi Sunak have been vying for the seat. Opinion polls have continuously put Truss in the lead. The contest was triggered by Johnson's resignation in July, following a series of scandals that led to several resignations from his cabinet. The winner has to get to grips with the UK's worst cost of living crisis in generations, a double-digit inflation, and soaring energy prices amid the war in Ukraine. Speaking of Ukraine, President Volodymyr Zelensky says his forces are pushing back Russian forces in the country's south and east. Zelensky says that a counteroffensive Kiev began last week has resulted in recapturing three towns as well as some territory. Now, this after Russian Defense Ministry said that forces have attacked what are called foreign mercenaries in Donetsk in the east. Two bases of the mercenaries were hit by precision weapons, according to the ministry. Meantime, local officials reported Russian shelling on residential areas in the southern port city of Kharkiv over the weekend. No word on the casualties. Italian Football League Serie A says it will put a 4-hour limit on the use of floodlights in stadiums on match days. The measure aims to cut energy use as the price have gone up. The government of Rome is in talks to adopt energy-saving measures ahead of wintertime. Max Tripoli has a report.
On Thursday, Italy's outgoing government discussed an energy-saving plan during a Council of Ministers aimed to save up for this winter as part of efforts to reduce the country's dependency on Russian gas. Ecological Transition Minister Roberto Cingolani's plan includes limiting the use of heating in apartment blocks and public buildings. Italians will be demanded to turn down the central heating by 1 degree and turn it off for an hour at dusk every day starting in October. Italy is struggling with increased energy costs as wholesale gas prices have surged to historic levels across Europe since the start of the conflict in Ukraine. Italy and a few other countries, including Belgium and the Czech Republic, are among those seeking an EU price cap on gas for power, but some members of the bloc, including France, are against this option. An emergency meeting of European Union energy ministers will be held in Brussels on September 9 to reach a consensus on tackling skyrocketing power costs.
We have a big gas problem. Our families and businesses are struggling, and politicians keep talking about making more debt to alleviate the crisis. But that would just be a patchwork. Italy must leave the TTF, the virtual trading point for natural gas based in the Netherlands, and then we can discuss a new LNG strategy.
Meanwhile, the Italian Confederation of Enterprises, Confcommercio, has warned some 120,000 Italian service sector firms could go out of business over the next 10 months.
I costi dell'energia sono ormai la vera emergenza.
The rise of energy costs is the real emergency.
Service sector firms will spend a total of 33 billion euros on energy bills, three times as much as in 2021. The government must speed up the procedures to access the funds of the EU Energy Recovery Fund and to make sure that the price cap on gas for power is adopted.
If energy costs keep rising at the current pace, Confcommercio, which has estimated that 370,000 jobs are at risk, is calling on the government to extend tax relief and to mandate that bills can be paid in smaller installments. The bad news for Italy doesn't stop there. Inflation jumped to 9% in August from 8.4% the month before. Financial analysts expect inflation to grow further, reaching 10% in October. Max Civili, Rome.
Clashes erupt in the Chilean capital of voters overwhelmingly reject reform to the constitution adopted during the rule of the 1980s dictator, Augusto Pinochet. Violence erupted after supporters of reforms took to the streets of San Diego to show their anger. Riot police used water cannons to disperse the ralliers. The reforms proposed by the incumbent president were rejected by 62% of the voters. The opposition has hailed the outcome, calling it a defeat for the government. The new constitution was proposed after the 2019 student rallies that morphed into wider discontent with the country's economic system. Confusion over what the new constitution would be like reportedly led to its defeat. President Gabriel Boric has vowed to continue working to change Chile's political landscape. Well, two people have been confirmed dead in the U.S. state of California as firefighters battle fast-moving flames in the northern mountainous areas. The two fell victim to the bushfire that began a lumber mill in the north. It's almost doubled in size since Friday, triggering evacuation of at least 1,000 residents. Strong winds are also fanning a separate wildfire in Siskiyou County, increasing its size. A state of emergency has been declared in the area. The two blazes have destroyed some 100 structures. California has seen its largest and most devastating fires over the past years amid a period of extreme drought. The Pakistan authorities are struggling to prevent fresh floods. The country's biggest lake risks bursting its banks. Water has already been released from the major freshwater lake of nearby districts, that in the hope of stopping a potential overflow and more floods as water level remains dangerously high. Authorities have also been forced to evacuate up to 100,000 people to make room for the breached water. Deadly floods have killed more than 1,300 people in Pakistan over the past weeks. It is triggered by record monsoon rains and melting glaciers in the north. The government and the United Nations both blame climate change for the extreme weather. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is a part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with Friday prayer leaders from across the country in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on July 27, 2022.
Sit down and talk with the young students, with the youth studying in the seminary. Today there are universities and seminaries in most of our cities. Well, they're all young. Talk to them. Go inside their groups and go to their schools and universities. Talk to them and invite them. Communicating with the youth is beneficial for the Friday prayer leaders as well. It has spiritual benefits because the younger generations normally have a new language, new thought, and new discourse. That's their nature. Don't fall behind this new movement of the youth. You'll become more familiar with their language, discourse, and the terms they use when you join them and start forming friendships with them. They will help you very much to be able to communicate with them, especially with the groups of the Basij. Get together and be with these good youth who are present in all our provinces and in all our cities.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Another recommendation is to participate in public social services. I must say that some of the respected Friday prayer leaders have honestly shone brightly in this area. They've helped out when there were earthquakes, floods, during the coronavirus epidemic, in social services, helping people, aid on the path of God, and in various other issues. This is one of those things that I think is very good. Helping the unprivileged classes, the poor and the deprived, should also be one of your top priorities. We are supporters of justice. We raise the flag of justice. Yet justice means nothing if we fail to help and care for the poor, the deprived classes, and the likes of them. One of the best things you can do in your groups is to help the underprivileged classes. Another point is the supervision of these Friday prayer joint committees. I would actually like to express my gratitude to the committees. The Friday prayer committees all over the country work very hard. They work a lot. They put in a lot of effort. Cooperate with them, see their work, monitor their work, and make sure they have no difficulties concerning their affairs. They are good people. They are good, believing people. Nonetheless, there are some people everywhere who interfere in things like termites. Be careful about this too. Another point and reminder that I have repeated many times before is that you should avoid getting involved in economic activities. It's not right for the Friday prayer leader to say, "Our Friday prayer needs money, it needs an income. We don't have any income, so we need to have such and such economic activity."
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
American intervention in Latin America began in 1823 when President James Monroe declared the continent to be a U.S. sphere of influence. Under the Monroe Doctrine, Washington claimed the right to intervene militarily across Latin America. That led to the Banana Wars, in which the U.S. military fought to reassert American power and monopoly of plantations in Central America, Mexico, and the Caribbean. Washington has so far orchestrated and supported many coups across Latin America that have been characterized as U.S. foreign policy in the region since the early 20th century. Throughout history, there's been a lot of U.S. meddling in Latin America, especially in Central America. U.S. foreign policy towards Central America heightened during the Cold War and the spread of the leftist movements and revolutions. Many believe that the success of the Cuban Revolution in the 1950s made the U.S. nervous to think that there could be political superpowers like the USSR at the time, leading them in getting involved in what they perceived as their backyard. All this set the stage for a sustained and violent U.S. intervention across Central America, backing vicious local allies in wars that claimed thousands of lives and displaced millions. The latest U.S. attempts of intervening in Latin America in its long list of interventions is considered as what it calls funding for democracy promotion in Cuba. Havana has, however, slammed the move, saying it's illegal and aimed at toppling the government. Let's not forget the USAID program in Cuba. As it was reported at the time, the U.S. secretly created Cuban Twitter to stir unrest and undermine the government of President at the time, Fidel Castro. It started a social network built on texts in hope that it could be used to organize smart mobs to trigger a Cuban spring. The island nation, which is currently facing its worst economic crisis in decades amid U.S. sanctions, announced electricity blackouts this month. Along with soaring food, fuel, and medicine prices as shortage grips, people are observing long queues for necessities. The U.S. trade embargo, which has been in place against Cuba since 1962, was reinforced under former President Donald Trump. Meanwhile, Trump's successor has also chosen to follow the same path. U.S. intervention has gone far enough that some Congress lawmakers have even advocated for bombing strikes.
We can go back to 1960, in fact, and the Mallory Rubottom memo, it's a State Department memo, that lays out the scenario that Cuba is experiencing today. It says that as secretly as the wording is actually as inconspicuously as possible to disrupt the livelihoods, the employment, the income of the Cuban people. So this has been a policy ever, you know, since 1960, April 6, 1960. The other part of that is that they intend to press the people into rebellion against the government. So clearly, regime change is part of the program.
Venezuela plunged into political turmoil after the U.S.-sponsored opposition figure Juan Guaido launched a botched coup to oust democratically elected President Nicolas Maduro. The attempted coup, which came with the green light off and support of Washington, is yet another example of Washington's intentions with Latin America. The U.S. has even imposed several rounds of sanctions against Venezuela aimed at ousting Maduro and replacing him with Guaido. The sanctions, which include the illegal confiscation of Venezuelan assets abroad and an economic blockade, have caused poverty, a lack of access to basic goods, gasoline shortages, and power cuts. But despite all this, the U.S. seems to have failed in its foreign policy regarding not only Venezuela, but Latin America as a whole, where most of the recently elected presidents have already expressed their ambitions of distancing themselves from the U.S. and establishing stronger ties among themselves.
And, you know, you're not asking this, but there is a new international realignment, and partly I think it's because of these blockades, because of the unilateral action by the United States against countries that are developing to impose its own financial rule on other countries. The United States needs to learn that other countries have a right to determine their own form of government, that their own way of living, that the people in those countries have that right without the United States putting them into debt, without sanctioning them, without creating hardships, and without military attack.
The latest turn of events is also an indication of the U.S.'s failed sanctions policy. Venezuela has, despite the sanctions, managed to double its oil production recently thanks to Iran's help. Iran itself, which is also heavily sanctioned by Washington, is also a prime example of the U.S.'s failed policies, as it has managed to withstand the economic pressure while gradually finding ways around them. The G7 countries have agreed to implement a price cap on Russian imports, despite warnings from the Kremlin to hold sales to countries imposing the restriction. Finance ministers of the United States, Japan, Canada, Germany, France, Italy, and the United Kingdom agreed on a plan to ban the provisions of services that enable maritime transportation of Russian-origin crude oil and petroleum products globally. This means importers seeking shipping services and insurance cover from companies based in G7 and EU countries would need to adhere to a price cap to transport Russian oil. The level of the cap is still being discussed. The German finance minister has stated the purpose of the move as such.
We want to limit Russia's revenues and at the same time reduce economic damage to our societies. This price cap on Russian oil exports is designed to reduce Putin's revenues.
The cap is expected to take effect at the same time as the next EU embargoes on Russian oil in early December. Moscow has warned that it will retaliate by banning oil exports to countries that implement the restriction. The Kremlin has warned that a price ceiling will significantly destabilize the oil markets, resulting in scarcity in global oil markets and soaring prices for European consumers. The ban is part of a range of measures taken by the West targeting Russia for the war in Ukraine. In response to the war, the U.S. decided to prohibit the import of oil, refined petroleum products, natural gas, and coal from Russia. These restrictions on Russian energy imports have contributed to higher gas prices and increased inflation pressure across the U.S. Washington's European allies are in no better condition. The European countries have plunged into a devastating energy crisis. Consumers are facing huge bills and the highest rates of inflation since the 1980s. Shell's chief executive officer has earlier warned that gas shortages could persist for several years, raising the prospect of continued energy rationing. Russian energy giant Gazprom has halted flows via the crucial Nord Stream 1 pipeline to Europe. The company cited an oil leak and didn't give a timeline of when the shipments might resume. This comes in the wake of the G7 countries' decision to impose a price cap on Russian oil. The continued shutdown of the pipeline could exacerbate the energy crisis in Europe, as it is the biggest pipeline for gas from Russia, accounting for about 35% of Europe's total Russian gas imports last year. Russia had already threatened to retaliate by banning oil exports to countries that implement a price cap. Since June, Gazprom has slashed flows through Nord Stream 1 to just 20% of its capacity, citing maintenance issues as a dispute over a missing turbine caught up in Western export sanctions. It has also cut off supplies to several unfriendly European countries and energy companies over their refusal to pay for gas in rubles. The West has already sanctioned many Russian energy exports, but Moscow has continued to earn billions of dollars a month by diverting oil to countries such as China and India. China's crude imports from Russia soared to a record level in May, ousting Saudi Arabia as the country's top supplier.
The prices that are being paid for Russian oil are far higher than the cost of actually extracting that oil. So what the Russians are taking advantage, in other words, of the situation they're imposing by their boycotts and by the war in Ukraine.
The West is trying to sever the Kremlin's revenues by imposing a ceiling for Russian exports. But Moscow has proved that it can reduce the exporting of its products to Europe and still have mass revenues.
Iran Central Bank says Tehran and Moscow have officially started doing business in their national currencies, adding both countries are considering de-dollarizing other parts of their economic ties. Tehran and Moscow had long been seeking to create a mechanism to replace the US dollar with their national currencies, rial and ruble, as part of a joint de-dollarization agenda, regardless of the tough economic sanctions in place against the two nations. Iran and Russia have both been subjected to tough economic sanctions by Western countries and are determined to deepen their economic cooperation, adding that there are great capacities for increasing the volume of bilateral trade. Several officials in Tehran and Moscow have repeatedly accused the United States of using the dollar as an instrument to wage economic and political war. China is another economic and political power that has opted to move toward de-dollarization. In fact, Iran, Russia, and China have discussed the de-dollarization of their trade for decades and have considered launching an alternative for the worldwide interbank financial telecommunication global network, or SWIFT. Following the breakout of the Russia-Ukraine conflict early this year, U.S.-led Western governments imposed several rounds of financial sanctions on Moscow, including freezing its foreign exchange reserves. The thought that the U.S. may move to confiscate one's assets in case they refuse to accept what Washington dictates has caused more countries to consider diversifying their reserve assets away from U.S. dollar. Consequently, many countries have turned away from European democracies and Washington. Regardless of who wins the Ukraine war, the United States and its allies will be the strategic losers. Russia will probably build closer relations with China and other countries on the Eurasian continent, including India, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and the Persian Gulf Arab countries.
We are seeing a deepening of ties unlike any other time that we've seen before. And ultimately, what this means is that the relationship between Russia and China is no longer being governed by the same economic rules that had governed it prior to this year. That is that Russian rubles are being traded. They're no longer doing business in dollars. And ultimately, that is hurting the United States. And it's going to change the dollar's hegemony.
In recent years, with the increased weaponization of the dollar and Washington's use of the dollar to sanction the so-called unruly countries in America's eyes, many countries in the world have awakened and begun to experiment trading in their own national currencies. Since the U.S. has been using the dollar and sanctions as a weapon to hurt other economies, its competitors have no obligation to help the U.S. maintain the dollar hegemony. The dollar's decades-long dominance has placed America in a strong position to dictate the terms of global trade and finance for the last 70 years. But this time, Russia wants to do something different, as Moscow is determined to launch a counter-offensive against Western sanctions and the dollar-centric global financial system. Following the unprecedented Western financial and economic sanctions, Moscow asked all unfriendly countries that are imposing sanctions on it to pay for their fuel purchases in Russia's rubles. The measure immediately helped stabilize the value of the ruble and significantly diffused the negative impact of Western sanctions. In addition to crude oil and natural gas, some economists have suggested Moscow extend the requirement for importers of Russia's grain, chemical fertilizers, and other products to transact in rubles instead of dollars or euros.
I think what we're witnessing now is the birth of a multipolar world order. And what that means ultimately is that after the collapse of the Soviet Union in the late 80s and early 90s, the United States became the single hegemonic global power. And what we are seeing now is that the United States, after two decades of brutal wars in the Middle East, in North Africa, of the rampant imperialist expansion and regime change policies and nation building policies of the US regime, that now Russia, China, Iran, Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua, South Africa, many countries are coming together and saying no more to US expansionism,
Russia and China certainly are engaged in a bid to change the U.S. rules-based order, but instead of trying to replace one hegemony, that is the dollar, with another, they are encouraging the rest of the world to assert their autonomy and independence.
Rising costs in the U.S. have pushed Americans to the edge with soaring inflation and the government's inability to control the matter so far. Inflation in the U.S. has shattered all previous records in March and currently is hovering around 8.5%. With inflation hitting the highest rate since 1981, the rising cost of living has been squeezing households and putting pressure on policymakers to bring the issue under control. And now government officials have warned Americans that the worst is yet to come. The U.S. Federal Reserve's Chair Jerome Powell has warned of pain ahead for Americans in the battle against inflation. While pledging that the Fed will continue to act forcefully, he also warned that the U.S. job market will suffer in order to get prices down. He says the damage which will be dealt to the job market is an unfortunate cost of reducing inflation.
Well, monetary policy only has an effect of 6 to 9 months of a lag. He just started raising interest rates here significantly in the last 2 months. So it won't really start to have an impact on inflation here until fourth quarter, maybe, of this year. But it won't have that much impact, I don't believe. I don't believe that it's going to be very quickly reducing inflation from its current 8.5% down to the Federal Reserve's 2% target here within the next 6 months or even within the next 18 months. I don't think they're going to get it down to that. They're going to continue raising rates because the only real solution, even if it is a limited solution, is monetary policy interest rates. They aren't going to hike taxes to slow down the economy. Government spending is just shifting from social program spending to military spending and subsidies to corporations kind of spending. So fiscal policy isn't going to do anything. Monetary policy can only have a limited effect, but the Fed is going to push that solution as high and as long as it can to shake out whatever it can shake out in terms of inflation.
According to recent surveys, Americans believe inflation tops the list of problems the country is faced with. This has led to U.S. President Joe Biden's approval ratings plunging heavily, leaving the Republicans criticizing him over the issue. Nevertheless, the U.S. government seems to be more concerned about the conflict in Ukraine, where it has so far given away billions of dollars in weaponry. The price of gasoline in the U.S. has witnessed a record high, averaging more than $5 a gallon in recent weeks for the first time ever. Meanwhile, Biden's attempts of lowering prices, which have included draconian measures like releasing crucial gasoline emergency reserves and even begging the Saudis to increase their oil output, have so far proven to be ineffective. While Americans are suffering and getting crushed under the dire economic situation, the government headed by Biden has just pledged another $3 billion U.S. dollars in aid to Ukraine. Washington has already assisted Ukraine with more than $18 billion in military aid since the launch of the Russian special military operation. But why is it that while Biden has described combating inflation as his top domestic priority, the government can't think about its own citizens before spending money on these wars?
This is only the beginning of subsidizing Ukraine. It's like $60 to $70 billion already in just 6 months. Ukraine says it needs $7 billion a month just to keep its economy going. Treasury Secretary Yellen of the U.S. Said we're going to give you $4 billion. So the U.S. is propping up Ukraine economically and militarily and so forth. It's becoming, you know, an economic satrapy of the United States. The U.S. is deeply penetrated economically in Ukraine. That's why it won't leave. And that's why, you know, it provoked this situation with this war purposely. The U.S. Really sees it's got, its 2 feet on the ground there in Ukraine. And its whole policy with regard to this war is just to continue the war in a low grade, well, maybe not so even low grade, for as long as necessary.
All in all, the U.S. is reeling from its support of Ukraine in its conflict with Russia, while its economy is seeing a severe downfall. But this is only the latest in a catalog of problems, from increasing social divisions and political paralysis to an inability to recover from the economic impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic. And all this has led many to believe the U.S. is losing its power and standing in the world.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitan rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at human beings from the perspective of Quran and Islam. We said there are two worldviews when it comes to mankind. There are those who are self-conscious and those who are world-conscious. Those who are world-conscious, they only care about themselves. Those who are self-conscious, it leads them to know Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, which is a different perspective altogether. Now, the main criticism projects towards the Western culture by the world's intellectuals is that the world-conscious culture, which bends and moves toward self-oblivion. Within this culture, man comes to merely know the world. The more he attains the awareness of the world, the more he forgets about his own being, which is natural. The more I indulge in my desires and pleasures, the more I become in the state of ghafla, as the Quran calls it. And when I am in the state of ghafla, I forget who I am, where I am, where did I come from, and where am I going. And I forget who even made me to begin with. Why? Because I'm no longer aware of these things. I'm just aware of my own self and my own desire. Now, this is something that the Quran and Ahl al-Bayt alayhi wasalam constantly speak of. Even the Quran, he says, when he talks about the concept of ghafla, the concept of unawareness, is that these people become like animals. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Quran, he says, but they are worse off. Kal an'ami bal adallu sabila. They are more misguided than animals, because animals, they have innate, they have fitra. The innate tells them that you need to do 1, 2, 3, and they follow program. Human beings, we have intellect, we have brains, we can think and we can act, we can create, we can invent, and so on and so forth, which animals are not capable of doing. So when I shut down that process of thinking and logic, then I turn myself to be in the animal kingdom. In fact, I will be worse off. Why? Because I have something that I'm not using. So imagine this. A man goes to the market with $1,000 in his pocket, but yet he can't buy a single meal because he thinks or he acts as if he has no money. You'll say this person is insane, which in fact he is, because he has the money, but he does not know how to use it, and he's not even using it. So Allah says, "Kal an'am," surely the between them and mules and animals, the similarity is the fact that they both care about the desires. But we will make humans worse off. أَضَلُّ سَبِيلًا is the fact that they have something that they are not using. If animals could speak, they would look to that human being and they say to him, have you lost your mind? Allah has given you a brain and you're not using it. You brought yourself to my level. So Allah says, no. Actually, sorry, we have insulted the animal kingdom. You are worse than that. So we need to become self-aware, not world-aware. Even though world awareness is also required, but it has to go in equilibrium with self-awareness, not just worry about this world and dive into it. Let us take a short break and then inshallah we will continue right after.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program for humanity. Now, we are talking about world consciousness and self-consciousness when it comes to the human being. Now, we said that a person will forget himself once he becomes only and only world-aware. Now, this is the actual mystery of the fall of mankind in the West. When man loses his own self, as we call it in Arabic, khusran al-nafs, which is a quote from the Quran, what would be the use of this mystery of the world? The strongest criticism of the Western culture in this aspect comes from the late leader of India, Mahatma Gandhi, in 1869 to 1948, in his book, My Religion. Gandhi says, a Westerner is able to achieve great feasts which other people assigned to the providence of God, yet he is unable to reflect on his inner self. This suffices to reveal the absurdity of the false glare of the modern civilization. I mean, he really summons up everything in this sentence or couple of sentences. That people in the West, they can achieve such greatness, they can create such magnificence as we can see in terms of technology, in terms of civilization and what have you. But in terms of reflecting on himself, they fail miserably. And that's why you see that when people extract all the pleasures and desires they can from this world, then they have nothing else to do, and they feel the void in themselves. Some of them turn to suicide, which the rates are crazy. If you can just go Google the suicide rates today, amazing rates, scary rates. Or some of them might turn to, as what we call today, inner peace and inner spirituality, which is also won't get you anywhere because sooner or later you'll get sick of it. Why? Because it has no goal, it has no aim. You just, again, even when you go into this self-meditation kind of form, you're only trying to please yourself. And pleasing yourself is very limited. But one needs to start pleasing Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, when he says, if you know yourself, you know your Lord, you need to reflect in your inner self. And this reflection should lead you to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Not to sit on a mountain and try to, you know, hum your way through the day and try to achieve self-peace. That might give you a bit of peace because you're disconnected from the world, but it won't get you anywhere. So self-awareness and world awareness, two different things, they need to be combined for us to be better human beings. And when you see people, sometimes they fall on either one of these spectrums. They either become so self-aware that they neglect the world, and those who become so world-aware that they neglect the self and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Islam teaches moderation. You have to be moderate. Kuntum ummatun wasata. You were a middle kind of ummah, nation created. So we need to be that. Not to fall on this side, nor on those side. We have no left and right in Islam. There's only the middle path. All right? We'll leave it here, and inshallah we will continue in other episodes. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. On this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will look at the 5 years of the mass exodus of Rohingya Muslims from Myanmar following a brutal military crackdown and their never-ending struggles. And we shall also discuss a new move by the Indian government in Kashmir to give non-locals voting rights in yet another attempt to change the region's demography.
It's been 5 years since hundreds of thousands of persecuted Rohingya refugees were forced to flee their homes in Myanmar following a military crackdown that was described by the United Nations as a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. One of the largest stateless populations in the world, Rohingya Muslims, have been denied justice. And even worse, their host Bangladesh and India are seeking their repatriation, even though the UN believes that conditions in Myanmar still aren't safe enough for them to return.
On August 25th, thousands of Rohingya Muslim refugees in Bangladesh's coastal district of Cox's Bazar, which currently houses the largest refugee camp in the world, marked the fifth anniversary of what they call the Genocide Remembrance Day. This day, 5 years ago, the Burmese military launched a sweeping campaign of massacre, rape, and arson against a vulnerable ethnic minority, forcing them to flee. According to conservative estimates, about 740,000 crossed the border into Bangladesh to escape the unutterable horror. About half of the Rohingya refugees at Cox's Bazar are children, and the ramshackle camps are prone to fires that have killed many of them over the past 5 years. The camps are also prone to flooding, especially during the annual monsoon season. Efforts to repatriate them have failed so far, despite Bangladeshi authorities maintaining that their repatriation is the only solution to the crisis. On the eve of the fifth anniversary last week, Bangladesh's Home Minister Asaduzzaman Khan said his country wants to ensure the Rohingya refugees can return to safe conditions in Myanmar. But the UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet, who visited the Cox's Bazaar in August, said the conditions in Myanmar still were not safe enough for the Rohingyas to return home.
In the horrifying violence that unfolded in Myanmar's Rakhine State 5 years ago, thousands of Rohingya Muslims were killed, women were raped, and houses were razed down. Those who managed to escape the violence are now stranded in Bangladesh's Cox's Bazar and some parts of India. The members of the persecuted community are unable to return home while struggling for survival in refugee camps under extremely miserable conditions. Those in Rakhine continue to face systematic abuses and crimes against humanity.
Rohingya Muslims are believed